It's time to step into the Coming Out Lounge, a cool, safe space to be true to your sexual self, with your host, Rick Clemens. Rick has helped hundreds of people come out of the closet, and now each week he's bringing you cool insights for loving and accepting yourself, boosting your self-confidence, and living a guilt-free, purpose-filled life on the other side of the closet doors. Cuddle up with yourself and get ready for heartwarming coming out stories, ideas for living authentically, and tips for being fully self-expressed. Now here's your host, Coming Out Coach Rick.
Hey, 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 Closet Busters. It is time once again to step out, step up, and step into living your powerful life. Yes, we're back with another episode of the Coming Out Lounge. My name is Rick Clemens. I'm the Coming Out Coach. And today, we have a little bit different coming out story. I've been on the hunt lately looking at, let's find some people we can talk to about how everybody's got closets and how everybody's hiding from something. And I had the beautiful opportunity to meet today's guest when I was at the National Speakers Association conference this summer. And we just happened to strike up a casual conversation, as you will do when you're at conferences and stuff. And as he started to talk, I realized this guy had a really beautiful story to tell. And I want to take you back to 1999. And I want you to imagine that the worst possible thing could happen, but you didn't die. Pretty close to it. It was you and some friends. But that horrible thing would change the trajectory of your life and the people around you for many, many years to come. In fact, it'll change you for the rest of your life. And I have to tell you that today's guest, he has come to a beautiful space of stepping out of his closet and talking about that night. He's found a way to really influence people and talk about what you should be doing when you're behind or as a passenger in a car, and how your senses and how you should stay attuned to those things that could possibly hurt you and others. He's found a beautiful, powerful way to share his story and talk about the injuries he sustained, as well as loving himself as an alcoholic. And I thought today's story would be really powerful because I know there's going to be parallels to coming out of the closet. And I want to welcome my new friend, Ed Divitt, to talk about his brain new day. Welcome to the podcast, Ed.
Thanks so much, Rick. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to have you, man. And, you know, it was kind of interesting. I never would have thought when you and I started having that casual conversation not too many weeks ago that it would turn into this. And then the more that I thought about it, and then you reached out to me and I had you on a list of people that I was going to follow up with after the conference, I had actually written next to your name podcast. So I'm really glad we're here today talking about this. And I know this is a story that you've shared numerous times. I know this is part of your desire to really carry this message forward to anyone who will hear it. So I'm going to just kind of let you take over and really begin to tell the story that I stepped into as we were, you know, doing the intro. But I want you to be the guy who really tells the story, because I think all of us tell our own stories best. So let's kind of go back to 1999 and what happened that evening.
Okay, Rick, thanks again. You know, on June 10th, 1999 is the date my journey began. You know, I just didn't know it at that time. It took me 15 years to be able to acknowledge that I had been given a gift. And, you know, I always wanted to hide from it, you know, and I always had drugs and alcohol were there to help me kind of sail through and fly under the radar, so to speak, you know, not being asked questions or, you know, just, oh, that's why he's wasted. He, you know, get a pass. I'm just that guy that's had a little too much, or it's always a little too often, and he's got problems, you know. That was it. But I never realized that this was something that I needed to dig deeper on and find out the true meaning of what my purpose was in this life. Or what my purpose is. So on June 10th, 1999, some friends of mine, just a friend of mine, were driving over, went to another friend's apartment. And this is kind of, this was the guy that we got our stuff from. And, you know, he was our dealer. And, you know, we ended up starting earlier in the day, you know, drinking and doing drugs. You know, alcohol was a magical elixir for me. You know, it took away the pain and made me feel good, made me forget who I was for a little while.
And what were you hiding from, Ed? If somebody were to, like, like I just did, ask you that question. What do you feel like you were hiding from?
I guess I was, you know, I did have somewhat of experience when I was younger. You know, growing up, youngest of five, my eldest sister had Down syndrome. And she also had, she was a diabetic. So I think, well, she had passed away when I was about 12. And we were really close. We had a bond like no other, you know. And because when our siblings, you know, grew up and they were, there's probably 6 years between myself and my next brother. So we were home a lot together and we were bonding. And, you know, that really hit me hard. Mm-hmm. So I was on kind of a downward spiral after that. And I started experimenting with alcohol. And that was what I thought was, wow, I have arrived. You know, this is what I need to do. This is how I can handle, you know, I didn't have an idea what I was feeling or why I was drawn to alcohol, you know, more so than my friends that were 13 or 14 years old. Mm-hmm. You know, not many kids at that age are looking to get out of their skin, so right. to speak.
Right.
And that's what I did. I just drank for the effect always, you know, and it didn't matter because it all started to taste the same and it didn't matter what I was drinking as long as it got me to where I needed to be.
Wow.
Yes. So we're over at a friend's house, but I mean, I am truly grateful and blessed to have had that experience growing up, Rick.
Yeah.
You know, like not everybody is fortunate enough to have someone in their life that has these challenges or these, you know, difficulties from on a daily basis. It gave me a real appreciation for life. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to foreshadow. I'll go back to the June 10th, 1999. We're over at a friend's house and we were kind of being, yeah, we were being a little noisy. It was his apartment. He didn't want to disturb the neighbors or draw attention for any reason. You know, God forbid the cops showed up.
Right.
So he had asked us to leave. So we're like, all right, we kind of threw our arms up and like, what's going on? Are you kicking us out? I don't recall much of it. Mm-hmm. So we left. And as we're leaving his driveway or as we're leaving his parking lot, a third individual came up and put his hands on my window. I had my window down. He's like, hey, where are you guys going? You know, a friend of the driver and mine. We were like, where do you need to go? You know, and he said, would you mind bringing me to my house, you know, across the river? And the driver said, sure, hop in. So I was about to get into the back seat and the driver reached over and put his arm on mine. And he said, Eddie, you're all right. Let him sit in the back. Let him get in behind me. You know, and that was, you know, he was probably 4 or 5 years older than me. I was 18 years old at the time. So shotgun was like a thing that, oh, sure. Yeah, I'll look cool and give this guy shotgun. I don't know where my head was, but the driver slapped me out of it and said, you're staying right there. So he climbs in behind the driver and away we went. Hmm. As we were approaching the Newburgh Beacon Bridge, we were kind of drifting from what the reports have told me. Mm-hmm. We kind of drifted into a tractor trailer. And I believe at that point, you know, the driver was kind of fearful of the outcome. You know, right. He didn't want to pull over and exchange information. I don't think we would have let him, you know, like we were just get out of there, you know, fight or flight
sure.
sunk in and we were flying out of there. So last thing that I recall was sitting reclined in my front passenger seat and, you know, I could just clear as day see the rafters of the bridge lit up under the dark sky, just kind of going by fast, and then it faded to black. Hmm. I didn't know what had happened, where I was, where my friends, you know?
Right.
I was on my back in the bed. I thought, I don't know what was happening. I don't know if we were in trouble or they put me in a home or I don't know. I didn't know where I was, you know? I didn't know which end was up, to be simple. It was a long road to recovery. I was in Westchester Hospital for about 18 days in Westchester Hospital in Valhalla, New York. Mm-hmm. That's an emergency trauma unit they have down there.
Right.
So, but what I wasn't aware of was, you know, why am I here? You know, what are my injuries? Nobody was telling me. You know, I do recall seeing vivid images of my family there, and they were all quiet. You know, they weren't talking to me. I think they were waiting for me to say something. You know, they were waiting for me to initiate the conversation.
Right.
Which was really played into the surreal, dreamlike existence that I was in. So after spending 18 days in Westchester Hospital, where I was unconscious, I don't know if I was in a medically induced coma or, you know, after a traumatic experience, you kind of lose the facts that are going on.
Right, right.
I did go from Westchester Hospital to Helen Hayes Rehabilitation Hospital, and that was in West Haverstraw, New York. And that's where they really focus, it's a rehabilitation hospital. That's where they put me back together, you know, gave me the skills to stand up, to balance on my own, where I had to relearn how to walk, talk, swallow liquids, and nothing really came easily to me. And me being 1 year out of high school, I didn't want to spend my summer relearning basic life skills.
Right.
I was already going. It was a long road for me to even be able to comprehend what had transpired on June 10th.
Wow.
Just a slow progression. So I come to find out, you know, and over the years, I did realize that it was told to me when I was in Helen Hayes Hospital. It was told to me that I'd been in a crash and, you know, I remember looking up to my brother and asking him, where are my friends, you know? And he just looked down at me and he put his arm on my shoulder and he's like, Eddie, I'm sorry, they didn't make it.
Mm.
And that was the point when I really knew I had to get well enough to be able to get out of there. If I was going to be able to stand up and walk, they weren't going to keep me there. You know, against my will, that's for sure.
Right.
Even though that was the best place for me at the time, I didn't want to see that. I didn't want that to be the reality. So back to the night of the crash, we had initially clipped into a tractor trailer, and that's what instilled fear in the driver. He stepped on it. We were traveling in a 1999 Ford Mustang GT.
Mm.
So it responded.
Pretty quickly.
Yes, definitely. And we ended up crossing the Newburgh Beacon Bridge, and on the opposite end of, on the beacon side of the bridge, lies the concrete toll barrier. And I don't know, but at that speed, I don't think the driver could have seen that the toll barriers were offset just a little bit to prevent someone from speeding through and not paying the tolls. We weren't trying to skip out on a $1.50 toll to cross the bridge. It was just get out of there fast.
Mm-hmm.
At the rate of speed that we were traveling, we hit the concrete that precedes the toll barrier. And it's kind of like dividing the toll booths up,
mm-hmm.
probably like 20 feet
yep.
before the toll. So we launched up off of that and kind of got airborne. And I have no idea how I can, you know, put two words together today, you know, because we launched off of the concrete, scraping the inside of the toll barrier, probably 20 feet up, there's digs in the concrete from where the car passed through.
Mm.
And then we landed probably 30 feet on the opposite side on the tires. Mm. The roof was smashed down completely. whoever saw this or heard us come through.
Yeah.
Didn't think that anybody could have survived.
That's amazing.
This was at 2 in the morning as well.
Mm.
So the fire department came and cut the roof off. You know, after we passed through, you know, people just came out and looked and it was quiet.
Mm.
You know, like, I couldn't imagine the debris field was all over, you right. know, sprayed across the pavement. There was, the car battery was recovered like 1,000 yards ahead of where we were. Like, it just launched out. And the rear seat passenger, you know, he was ejected.
Hmm. That's got to be a big, big moment for you when all that came to a head, so to speak, when you started to have the realizations. This was only you who survived.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about coming out and coming into realizations. I guess that was probably one of the big closets for you, was really stepping out of that closet to go, I'm the only one who survived this.
Right. I didn't even want to acknowledge it. You know, I wanted to go back to how my life was before the crash.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to hang out with the friends that I was with before that. So, of course, doing the same things, expecting different results, that was me. You know, I was running with the same crowd and I drank again. You know, they tell you not to drink probably 5 years post
right.
a traumatic brain injury. When you sustain a traumatic brain injury, you don't need to be flooding your brain with alcohol.
Right.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
So it took me 15 years, Rick, to finally break out the skeletons in the closet and acknowledge my invisible injury.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to be able to speak to other people about my traumatic brain injury, and that's part of the rehabilitation that I wasn't allowing myself to do by kind of skating over it, you know, and nobody would really know unless I make it a point like I do, because you can't see the invisible injury.
Mm-hmm.
People can't see what your thinking process is or
right.
what frustrates you and what, you know, so it's not as evident as like a broken arm or a broken leg. And that's another thing people don't understand, that the brain heals differently than bones.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can
say, it's not like, okay, back to normal. Let's
yeah,
go out and do things.
I can actually say from my experience of meeting you that had you not started to talk about this, I would not have assumed there was anything. I could tell by the way you spoke that there was, you know, some slower cadence to how you talk, but I wouldn't have thought anything other than, okay, well, obviously something's happened, but I don't know that it's anything bigger. Maybe this was what he was born with or whatever it may be. I've had friends who have had, you know, speech impediments and things like that. So I'm very used to being around people like that. But the thing that struck me the most as you were just now talking was this thing is not visible, which is a very, very similar parallel path to people who are in the closet.
Mm-hmm.
Unless somebody is an overtly masculine or, you know, masculine female or an overtly feminine male who personifies the stereotypes of gays and lesbians, to meet someone, you don't really know their sexual orientation. It's a very quiet thing unless they happen to be just manifested in a very overt way. And I found it interesting to start to see the parallel as you were starting to talk. You know, you talked about being in the closet about this, about how you didn't want to talk about it and going back to the friends and you know, and going back to the habits. I've had several clients that I've worked with throughout the years where they're like, I wish I could just go back to my old life. And what they don't realize is even if they're not completely out to people, there is no old life to go back to. All you can go back to is what you know you had. And I kind of picked that up as you were describing things that, yes, you went back, you got back into the other crowd, you started drinking again. But in reality, Ed, it sounds like there really wasn't the old life that you went back to, correct?
Correct.
And that had to be a big moment, too, of coming to your own closet door, so to speak, of, okay, and this still isn't really who I am or how I want to be in the world either.
Right. Right. I get that a lot, you know, but I kind of play it off like I'm actually from out west sometimes.
Yeah.
When you were talking about my accent, because I'll be playing along with people that are like, where were you from? And I'm like, I was born and raised in Orange County, New York. And they're like, no, you sound like you're from out west.
Mm.
Going back to the remarks about my slow cadence.
Yeah.
It was amazing to, you know, realize that other people had the same injury. Other people can identify, you know. We have strength in numbers, you know. Mm-hmm. When two people that share the same thing, you know, the same invisible injury, get together and they can start talking, you know, about shortcomings, or, you know, there's a liberating thing where you can just, you feel open enough to discuss anything because they understand you.
Right.
They speak your lingo.
Yep.
Now, but see, I've been put on a path, Rick, to help others understand things that they might not be able to see. And, you know, I've been looked at like, okay, it's 10 in the morning. What time did you start drinking? And, like, I don't drink or I don't do substances anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Only for today. But it's showing that, like, I'm not doing that. And, and instead of getting offended or trying to claim my sobriety, you know, I'm just like, whatever. You know, you want to play along with it? Okay.
Well, but I think this is another beautiful parallel to the coming out journey for someone who's coming out of the closet in their sexual orientation is at some point you embrace who you are. And, you know, I remember when you and I were shooting emails back and forth prior to getting this all set up, and you said what I came out of was this. It was really beautiful to hear you say those words of embracing who you are with your, you know, traumatic brain injury, as well as admitting that you are a alcoholic. At some point, we have to just embrace this. And that's one of the biggest steps for people that I support and help navigate through this journey is embracing that they're gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender or queer, whatever that thing is that they need to embrace to feel whole again. Mm-hmm. That's one of the biggest pieces of the whole entire recovery process, so to speak. And I'm not saying that coming out, you know, as a gay or lesbian is a recovery process per se in the truest sense, but in a way it is. You got to recover from everything you've been hiding for all these years. So I know when you and I were, you know, shooting emails back and forth, you did use the terminology, you came out. So what was that pivotal moment when you finally realized I need to come out and I need to really come clean about all the stuff I'm feeling, that I have a brain injury and that I'm an alcoholic? What was that inciting moment for you? Or was it a lot of moments? I'm sure.
Well, I just wanted to share with you also that, you know, because I am an alcoholic and I do suffer from addiction, and there is never enough, you know, once I get started. So,
right.
You know, that's me. I'm an alcoholic / addict. And it's crazy because that disease tells you you're okay.
Mm-hmm.
Keep secrets. Just go about doing what you're doing. Everything is fine, you know. Throw in a brain injury on top of that, it kind of like magnifies. One plays off the other. Alcoholism plays off the brain injury, and brain injury vice versa, you know. I really couldn't tackle both, and I wasn't able to come out of the closet about my traumatic brain injury until I was able to acknowledge that I'm an alcoholic. And that I do need help for that. And that I do need to surrender myself on a daily basis in order to stay away from the next drink.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was able to wrap my hands around that after slipping, you know, I was like, okay, well, what am I keeping secret? You know, and that's when I realized, oh, yeah, wasn't I in like a crash, you know, 15 years ago? Didn't they say I have a traumatic brain injury? And here I am telling people now, like my family, who was with me through the whole experience, you know. I've been like, remember like back in 99 when I was in that I have a traumatic brain injury, and I'm starting to talk about that now. But that acknowledging my own self, you know, something that I wasn't able to do.
Well, but that's a big piece, though, is when we can acknowledge that then, and I know you're getting ready to deliver something really beautiful here, but this is the moment that things begin to shift.
Right. Definitely. So I'd been going to AA meetings, and a friend of mine from the rooms, she also had a TBI, traumatic brain injury, and she had asked me if I'd ever been to a support group. And I was like, I don't know about that. You know, like, I'll come down. I'm just, like, busy right now. So I was kind of brushing her off. After a while, I was like, you know what? She keeps asking me, and I'm giving her some BS excuse. So I'm going to go. I'm going to go down there, and I'm going to, you know, just check it out. So I go down there, and I sat around this table with 12 other individuals that knew exactly how I was feeling. They were just sharing what they go through on a daily basis, things that bother them, you know, how things used to be.
Right.
You know, the process itself is what brought me to the place. These were people that had to rely on services to drive them there. You know, they weren't able to drive themselves, or they needed other forms of support. And right. I'm sitting here at this table just thinking, my goodness, you know, I've been blessed so much, not only to be alive, but to have the faculties that I do have. You know, I drive on a daily basis. I don't have to rely on support for that.
Sure.
I mean, but just so many things that I had been taking for granted were put right in front of my face. And I said, you know what? This is my job. This is my duty from here on in. These are my people, you know? Like, I totally get them. I know exactly what they're talking about. They speak my lingo, you know? And that's when I said, okay, I'm going to see what can I do. I All right. got in touch with the Brain Injury Association of New York State. The president came out and met me, and I just said, what can I do to be of service? How can I help you? You know, and from that, I went down to Washington, D.C., and it was called Hill Day, Brain Injury on Capitol Hill in March. They do that annually.
Sure.
So I go down there and I speak to them and speak to representatives about people living with traumatic brain injury, you know, right. like other support services. So I also went up to Albany on the state level, and I've been advocating up there as well. It's just tremendous how much my world has opened up and all the opportunities that I've been blessed with. You know, just by doing something that I was so reluctant to do, by shedding light on something that I was literally growing mushrooms on. Nobody was going to unbury my secret because I wasn't even sharing it with my family. I wasn't discussing it, you know, so I was keeping it in the dark. And I'm so grateful and thankful that it's been brought to the surface, because I wouldn't be who I am today if I had never given it a chance and acknowledged myself, you know, this is me, and embracing it and loving it and just sharing like there is no end.
So as we have heard, there's many, many parallels here to the coming out journey. There's the denial, and there's the hiding our truth, and then the realization that by stepping in and sharing our truth and showing who we are, we begin the healing process, not only with ourselves, but with others. One of the things that I think you've demonstrated really powerfully is we all have these closets. The closets that we hide in can take on many, many different shapes, sizes, depths. They all can be painted in different ways so that nobody sees who we really are and what we're hiding. So I'm just curious, as we kind of wrap things up here, Ed, what do you feel like the thing you've learned most about yourself by coming clean and really stepping out of this closet of being someone who's an addict and been able to embrace that you do have a TBI? What do you think you've learned most about yourself?
That I am, you know, I am perfect. You know, I am perfect in God's eyes. You know, there is nothing that I cannot do. You know, there are no limitations because of a brain injury or because I'm an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. You know, and just be willing to listen. What's really kind of launched me into this speaking journey as well with the embracing it, my invisible injury and my addiction, mm-hmm. is how many people I can help.
Yeah.
You know, distracted driving, you know, in New York State, and I'm sure nationally, no longer are the days when vehicles crash because somebody's under the influence of alcohol and drugs. Today, it's cell phones, you know, and distractions because of other people in the car or people messing around with the radio and having too much technology at their fingertips to take their attention off of driving a 2,000-pound piece of metal at 60 miles an hour.
Right.
Being able to use what has been freely given to me mm-hmm. for the benefit of countless individuals, you know, and when I speak in front of schools, I'm not looking to get everyone's attention. Not everybody is going to hear the message that I have to give, Rick.
Yeah, yeah.
But if I can get maybe one or two people to not have to put their families through what I put my family through, that helps me lay my head down on my pillow and sleep well, you know, because I'm able to use something that I never wanted to discuss and allow it to shine some light on another individual's path.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's a really, I think that's a perfect place for us to kind of wind it up here, Ed, because you've given that beautiful message of, you may think you're only one person, but if only one other person truly benefits from what any one of us in the world does, I think we've lived a pretty good life. And we've done what we've been brought here on this planet to do. So thank you, my friend, my new friend, for taking time out of your day and sharing of yourself so beautifully today. I can't tell you how much I appreciate this time we've had.
It's my pleasure, Rick. And, you know, I just want to say you're a great individual. And, like, there was something that was drawing me into sharing with you wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad that this opportunity arose and
me too.
You asked me to come on your show.
Oh, me too. I know this will resonate with so many people when they really take the words that they've heard you say today and take it into their hearts. Because when you listen to this, I'm going to encourage all of you maybe to even re-listen to this one and go, where am I in my journey? Whether your journey is coming out of the closet to say I'm gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender, or your journey may be I'm sitting here in corporate America and I'm miserable and I need to come out and be honest with myself and with others. There's so many beautiful parallels in the story that Ed just shared with you, and I hope you'll take advantage of what you've heard and do some loving self-care with yourself. Ask yourself those bigger questions of, what's my closet that I'm ready to come out of? So we're going to wrap it up for another week on the Coming Out Lounge. I'm Rick Clemons, the Coming Out Coach. And never stop stepping out, stepping up, and stepping in to living your powerful truth. Hey, 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 closet dwellers and Coming Out Lounge listeners. I wanted to invite you to check something out. You know, for all the years that I've been a Coming Out Coach, one thing I've learned is sometimes people come to do the work with me and they only need a little bit of help to get over something very particular and very important to them. It could be reconciling their religion and sexuality. Maybe it's learning how to have the difficult conversations where they say, I'm gay. Possibly it could be, oh my God, I'm out of the closet, but now how do I do this same-sex dating and mating sort of thing? Well, what I can tell you is throughout the years, there are common things that show up over and over and over again. And what I've heard most from my clients and listeners of the podcast is, I want a way to work with you just on these particular subjects. Yay, I am so excited because I've taken the action and I've made this possible. So how do you find out about these particular programs? You go to thecomingoutcoach.com, or if you're on the show page right now listening to the podcast or have just listened to the podcast, over to the right-hand side of the podcast description, everything is an icon that says one-on-one coaching sessions. click on that button, you'll be taken to a page that describes each of the different 9 sessions I'm offering. They are one-on-one sessions that we can do via phone, Skype, or even FaceTime. They're very action-oriented. We go right to the topic that you want to talk about. And each of these sessions also includes a copy of my book, Frankly, My Dear, I'm Gay. So what more could you ask for? You get me for 90 minutes devoted to you, plus my book. So go check it out. See if there's something that could help you as you step out, step up, and step in to living your powerful truth. Take care. I'm Rick Clemons, the Coming Out Coach. I look forward to working with you.
You've just experienced the Coming Out Lounge. Go online to www.comingoutlounge.com to learn more. And tune in again next week for more stories and tips for being true to yourself.